For me, day one with a brand new dog is going to be maybe one or two tracks in the grass. It's going to have three or four 90s. Right off the bat, there is most likely not going to be anything on the track payment-wise. I'm going to load the marker with the dog first, and I'm going to mark the dog for specific behaviors that they offer along the way. So I try to tell guys, look at your leash as your Skinner box. You're giving the dog a good bit, 10, 15 foot of line, and saying, use it wisely. So the dog is painting the picture. I'm just marking specific things that the dog does along the way.
Welcome to the Working Dog Depot podcast with your hosts, Rich Harden and Howard Young. Welcome to the Working Dog Depot podcast. I'm flying solo today. Rich was having some difficulty getting checked in, and we wanted to go ahead and do this episode. Since we had Mike on the line, I want to introduce Mike Lilly. Welcome.
Hey, everybody. How you doing? I'm glad to be on here. It sucks Rich couldn't get on, but we'll make do. I think we can handle it.
I think so, too. We got to figure that out, though. That's not going to work for us long term at all.
Yes, sir.
So we've had an opportunity to meet a couple times, and we've chatted about some mutual interests. And it's interesting that your name seems to have become very synonymous with tracking.
Yes, sir.
Intentional, or was that something you found?
No, completely by surprise to me. It's I remember when I first got like a pretty decent seminar invite, I was like, man, why didn't anybody want to hear what I have to say about getting a dog to track somebody? So the fact that it's gotten to where it's at just blows my mind for sure.
So you could provide as much detail as you want. I know, like most people, you probably are doing things a little bit differently than when you first started. And then, a lot of folks evolve. In fact, that was part of our conversation when we were speaking at the Hold the Line conferences, that you felt like you had made some changes. I'm just interested in your process in general. But before we get down that road, let's tell folks a little bit about yourself and how you ended up where you are. And I know that you've been in law enforcement.
Like anybody, I think that works in dogs now probably got a early on start, just like I did growing up. My dad always had quite a good herd of dogs. Like I always say, I'm pretty sure they had me and my brother just to be able to take care of dogs. So I grew up hog hunting, was a nightly thing. I was raised on a large vegetable farm operation. So my dad had hundreds of thousands of acres to be able to hunt, and we lived right there. So that was a huge part of our life growing up hog hunting. And then went into rodeo, got into rodeoing and working on ranches. And so getting around cow dogs every day and really loved raising dogs and watching them work. That was really life for me. It was pretty much 7 days a week. As soon as I got off work, I would unload horses, feed, and load dogs up and go right to the woods. So, and I had at a young age a lot of interactions with what I grew up calling game wardens, but fish and wildlife officers, because we hunted a lot. So we interacted with them a lot. And I really thought that was the coolest job ever. And, got to a point where I was like, man, I really want to get into, you know, law enforcement and become a game warden, and started on that path, got hired, went through the academy, got on our special operations team and did an undercover gig for a little bit, got my time up to where I was able to apply for a canine position when it came available. So I applied for that. And was selected for my region. There was, I believe, two handlers selected. I was one of them. And, you know, really started on this path of something that I had a great passion for and really learned hunting bad guys with a dog was a whole nother realm of possibility. Like, I love being a cop, but man, you put a leash with a dog that knows how to find a, you know, a bad human being or a missing person. It's like nothing else in this world. So, there were some training issues that I saw weren't ever going to change. And, my sheriff at the county that I worked in predominantly was always hounding me about coming on board with them and getting in the canine. So I made that jump to the sheriff's office where I worked and ultimately became the sergeant and trainer for my unit, was able to kind of build it from the ground up, put some new guys in there, get rid of some lazy guys and get some good dogs. And, still to this day, as I'm working with that sheriff's office and providing dogs and training programs and being a training coordinator for them. So, and then started training pet dogs at some point. And realized, holy crap, why am I out here, you know, working for pennies when I could be doing a whole lot different? Really hated to get away from the law enforcement side of it, but it was just a good financial decision and life decision to retire. So I did 12 years and me and my wife moved to Tennessee from South Florida and started the pet business. And now I get to, you know, travel and do so many seminars and also doing trainer schools and canine schools at our Ridgeside location, that it provides that kind of scratches that itch for the passion of police dogs while we still are running the pet dogs. So currently we have our MLK9 locations, and then we also have our larger Ridgeside Canine Knoxville, where we have full-time groomers. We have doggy daycare, full boarding. And then I've also got trainers. We do anywhere from 30 to 50 board and train dogs a month. And so stay very busy with that. And my main job now is to leave my wife alone to doing the work and dog stuff so that I stay out of her office. So currently that's what I get to do. So I get to work with agencies still and still be able to help them, you know, with whatever they need. I tell guys all the time, my door is open. Any agencies around me that want to come and pop in that are having issues, it's, you know, completely free. It's just the ability to help out and keep these guys and girls working with dogs and providing a service to their community. So, yeah, in a nutshell, that's kind of how we ended up where we are here in East Tennessee. We're right here in Knoxville, so. Great place to live. I miss South Florida, but boy, I love it here.
Really? That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, obviously you kind of cover the whole gambit. So tracking is just really one facet of what you do, but you've garnered a good bit of positive attention. So you obviously are doing some things that are resonating with people and that they like. And the bottom line is they must be getting results, and that's what's bringing them back.
Yeah, you know, getting those videos after seminars of dogs, you know, doing a really, really good job. And maybe prior to the seminar, the handler and dog weren't finding anybody and just kind of chasing their tails. And so it's really cool to be able to help out and see that progression pretty quickly. The system that I've kind of honed into now really creates very fast change and gets the dog to doing what the dog's responsibility is, the work. It shouldn't be on us because we don't have the nose and we're not the dog. So that's really the path that I set out on whenever I decided, man, there's all these systems out there, but none of them standing alone work really well. And as a cop, that tracking was what paid my unit's bills big time. I mean, we were tracking a lot, and I was lucky to have a sheriff that held me and my unit accountable. If the helicopter, if we requested for it to go up, we needed to have somebody in handcuffs, because if the sheriff's going to pay that fuel bill and overtime for it, we better be able to provide. So I think that's a big thing that would help out happening a little bit more is some accountability for trainers to step their game up and maybe not be just doing the things that we've always done. We hear that in a lot of my seminars. Well, it's just because that's what we've always done. And it's no fault of anybody, but man, there's so much more information out there than what we've always had. So yeah, tracking has definitely been something that I get hired for a lot. And I love tracking, man. I really, really love watching a dog work and find a human being that has ran off and is trying to evade a dog. So
very good. So we all know that there's multiple ways to do things, but what does your process look like?
So it's it really, after going to NEPO Post Silver and Gold, it kind of sparked something of let's stop getting so involved with the training. I did a lot of Dick Stahl stuff, a lot of Schützen style, you know, crop circles and food in footprints. And I mean, you name it, I've done it. Hits, the hydration. It's just nothing I found really created a tracking behavior that was trustworthy. I mean, there was constantly times where dogs are blowing turns and lifting their head and, you know, the ultimate goal is to find that human being. But then also, you know, with these high drive dogs, we forget so much about the energy management and getting these dogs to function at a lower state of drive so that they can do a day shift 95 degree 2 mile long track and still have enough gas in the tank to fight a really bad human being and get them into custody without exhausting themselves and putting themselves into heat exhaustion just because of the manner in which they track. Getting them to do detection where a handler can walk into a school sniff and do, you know, 10 cars, 15 rooms and 20 locker banks and backpacks and not have the dog, you know, make it two rooms in and tongue be hung out and just exhausted. And then it goes into just guessing and it really goes down the drain pretty quickly. And these are all things that I dealt with my second dog, just a lot of dog. And so my system really hones on let's put toys away for a good while. Let's go to existential reward. Let's utilize a marker. Let's start layering. Let's change the way we look at e-collars, where it's not just looked at as a tool for corrections. And I get that all. Why are you stimming the dog for sniffing? Why are you stimming the dog for tracking or doing detection? It's not about corrections. Let's change the way we think about it and use it as a gas pedal and a motivator so that way later on we can say, hey, I don't want you to do that behavior anymore. But what it relies mostly on is that accountability. It's telling the dog, when I say track or when I say go do detection, you have to do this job. Dual-purpose dogs always want to select biting, where there has to be clarity of task. And so often where I travel, we don't see true clarity of task. It's the dog deciding periodically through a track that it will actually track. The rest of the time when it's not really tracking, it's looking for somebody to fight or a direction to go that's more fun, where there has to be that accountability. And that's kind of what my system after going to Silver and Gold was, okay, let's try to free shape this tracking game, let the dog create it, but also hold the dog accountable at some point to, hey, if there's a 90 here, you need to slow down, not pick up speed, don't get frantic, don't start circling around me, running and looking at tree lines. Let's really use your nose and take the turn so that I can ultimately, as the handler, just follow you after I tell you to track.
Oh, wow. That sounds great. One of the things that I see and hear often is dogs tracking too quickly, mm-hmm. too fast.
Yep.
I know that's been an issue for some of our dogs. And I will say that the most effective ones are the ones that are more methodical. So I'm really interested in hearing more details about what this looks like from start to finish. But, mm-hmm. You know, I think there are a lot of pitfalls that we make, and I don't know why I'm having these epiphanies so late in my career, but I was thinking about why, you know, we should not be surprised about a dog going quickly on a track when the prize is always at the end.
Hey, folks, we're excited to tell you about one of our new sponsors. That's Ray Allen Manufacturing. Ray Allen has been making canine-related products since 1948. Many of you recognize the name Ray Allen with being synonymous with quality canine gear. Both Rich and I have been ordering equipment from them for years. My now adult sons have shared with me that some of their childhood memories involve seeing Ray Allen catalogs at home. That's right, folks, catalogs that came in the mail before the internet. Over the past few years, we've gotten to know some of the faces behind the scenes and have come to appreciate them for who they are. We've also enjoyed the banter back and forth. I've been the subject of at least one prank. It's relationships like these that are icing on top of the cake when it comes to doing business with a company. When searching for canine-related gear, seek out a trusted name in the industry. That's Ray Allen Manufacturing. For a 10% discount, use the WDD10 discount code. Thank you.
That's right. That's what I say all the time. If we made our tracking and detection look more the same, kind of meet in the middle, where traditional tracking has been one payment at the end, traditional detection has been multiple payments for however many hides there are. If we limited payments in detection ultimately and maybe raised payments in tracking a little more and paid for not just getting to the end, but let's pay for specific behaviors, mouth being right, closed, moving at a good pace, head being down, implementing a distraction on a known track and the dog recovering from that distraction and paying and ending right there, not fighting them and then knowing, well, crap, I've still got a toy 500 yards down range that I've ultimately got to get to. So we help the dog along doing very crappy subpar work, and then they get paid for it. Yeah. Exactly. And then we say, hey, that wasn't great, but here you go. Here's your end payment. So that stuff, you know, and I've done a ton of Dick Stahl stuff. My second dog had already had multiple street bites by the time I went to my first Dick Stahl seminar and really started learning that back chaining and article based method. But then I found, especially with my second dog, that the problem that I have with that system, it's a great system, but number one, it takes a very long time to do it right. And most of us, when we're teaching police dog schools, we don't have that kind of time as contract trainers. If you are the unit trainer, you've got, you know, every chance you can get a hold of that dog to refine it. But as a trainer giving the dog out to the agency, you don't get that amount of time. The second downfall to it is, which is really hard to overcome, is the article recovery and alert is the primary behavior instead of tracking. The primary behavior is recover the article and give me the final response. There's hours and hours spent on building that behavior. The secondary behavior is the actual tracking, where I need the track to be the primary behavior. It's too easy to build that down and stare at an article in that really pretty method. That comes later on, at least in how I do it. I want very slow, methodical tracking, energy management, the dog learning how to maintain its energy the entire way through the track, how to be honest with me. That was something that was screamed at me with my first trainer. Well, trust your dog. It was always place the blame on the handler. And my argument was always, help me make him trustworthy. Like, I'm not the trainer, and he's not trustworthy right now. He's just running into oblivion. Track to him, when I gave that command, it just meant take off and use your eyes and guess a lot of the way, where now I want more accountability for the dog and really to learn how to move efficiently.
That's really good. You've got me wanting to learn a whole lot more. I can tell you, historically, we've seen some changes in dogs. I would say I started, we certainly had lower drive shepherds.
Yeah.
And I'm really dating myself. There's a VHS series that was through Learburg, which was the Royal Canadian Mounted Police.
Yeah, yeah.
Tracking and drive.
Yeah.
And I took lots of pieces of that. And I feel like you could get away with that with some of those dogs.
Yeah.
Now, with the dogs that we have today, there's no way.
Yeah. Yeah. Because these with the brains in outer space. No way.
Exactly. There's somebody behind every tree.
That's right.
They can't. I at least figured that out on my own. It took me a while.
Yeah, that's right.
But right now, I've got a dog that I am actually teaching the article in the box. Mm-hmm. And I'm really curious as to where where you go from there. You sound like you've adapted. You've changed some things.
I'm also rewarding the dog with movement. I'm not a fan of verbal continual markers, but in my system, that continual marker is movement. So that continual payment is, if the dog's doing something I don't desire, then I'm not moving. As soon as it offers something that I desire, I may take a step and I want them to hear me take that step. I may scuff my feet, but I want the dog to know. And you'll see a lot of them look over their shoulder like, oh, we're going somewhere. And then they'll offer that again. And right there, I can mark it. So I may pay a dog several times in a very short track. But if you look at how much communication and clarity of task that I was showing the dog in those payments as compared to just walking a track, dropping a Kong, or walking a track and having a decoy be there, I think it's tremendously different. And then after those one or two grass tracks, they go immediately to very distracting environments. Something I learned early on was in my first dog school, we always went to this very secluded, very quiet sod field in South Georgia. Then by the time we finally, after 6 or 7 months, went somewhere where there may be one human being there, the dogs were like, oh my God, there's a person. That person's probably got my rolled up towel. I should run and go over to them. Because we had signed a contract with the dog very early on that we only track in very secluded, very quiet areas, where I want to sign a contract with the dog right off the bat because I'm loaded on my marker. I'm paying with existential reward. So I have a very in-tune captive audience from the dog. I can get through anything and very quickly let them struggle through where the learning will occur, more advanced in my opinion, where that myelin is going to be created even more in those distracting environments. So the first week of a handler school, the dogs are tracking downtown on sidewalks, past people, past dogs, past mowers, joggers, everything, because I want to make that contract early on with the dog to say, hey, this is where we're working. Same as in detection. I want detection started in the environments I'm working in. The first week of handler school, I'm going to be working dual and single-purpose dogs in Rural King, putting odors out in the aisles, working around people, shopping and stocking shelves. When it looks like that to the dog, distractions aren't a problem. We cause the issue with the distractions because we do it very late in the game. Now we've already signed a contract with the dog saying, hey, we are going to run boxes. It's going to be like a tennis match. Everybody's going to be quiet. And that's where we're going to train the dogs. And then at some point we switch to, okay, let's go somewhere more distracting. And now we're fighting the dogs on getting over distractions. So I try to do this very early on and show them that this is where we're working. Every day, this is going to be their environment. And it moves very, very, very quickly. Dogs are tracking at, for at least my standard, a very high level within the first week or two of canine school. So they're pretty well finished within that second month that we're working with tracking.
You have somebody lay the track, or you lay it yourself? Do you?
Yeah, I do. I do all daddy tracks, everything.
Okay.
Because I don't trust track layers.
Right.
You can have your best buddy that you trust with your life, but I do not trust him to lay me a track like I want. So I do all of my own tracks, because if I'm to hold the dog accountable for very good behavior, then I've got to know it. And the rule of thumb I tell guys, we're working for perfection. And I don't mean this from a arrogant standpoint. I mean this from a, if our training is perfect and we strive for perfection in training, then our live deployments are going to go good. If our training is good or a little less than good, our live deployments are not going to go very well. They're going to be pretty rough. So we want to make sure that we're working for perfection. So I lay my own and I do all known tracks for a very long time.
I think there's a tendency for guys to want to move quickly into the unknown tracks,
yep,
way before they're ready.
Exactly right.
It's a pride thing.
That's it. And putting out odors unknown, and then they start, you know, paying dogs for stuff that's not correct, and allowing dogs to you know, do it. They're doing an unknown and the dog starts sniffing rabbit poop and they let them sit there. Well, we know what is allowed will continue. And if we've said track and the dog thinks that these things are allowable, then that's what tracking will look like. Take, for example, you know, I see a lot of guys, and I was one of them with both of my dogs. We lay maybe a certification type track, maybe two or three 90s in there. We begin the track. The dog picks up a direction of travel, raises his head slightly. His mouth comes open. He picks up pace. We get to the 90. The dog blows right by it. We stop him after maybe a leash length. They, you know, wrap a circle around us once or twice. The dog realizes now there's no movement from dad, so maybe there's something here that they need to pay attention to. They pick up that 90-degree turn, or, God forbid, the handler presents it after getting irritated with the dog, and now they continue on, and then they get a payment. Well, we said track in the beginning, so the dog thinks that that's his contract. Like, that's what it looks like to the dog. They think that just like sit may mean the dog hears the command two or three times, maybe there's a correction, and then he finally sits, as compared to, hey, when I give this command, this is the task I want, and I'm very clear on explaining it to the dog. And then I explain to them there's going to be accountability for blowing that 90-degree turn or running loops around me or staring off at a tree line, because at the end of the day, on a live, unknown track, once you're ready to actually do that, my rule of thumb is, do so many knowns, you cannot get an unknown wrong. If you get to the point where you are killing known tracks and you're just following the dog, then you're ready to do an unknown. Because when you get to that unknown, at the end of the day, it's just following the dog's tail. The leash checking and all that stuff, that's what I was taught. Yes, you can get good at it, but it takes a handler and a dog, you know, a few years before they're at that solid point where we need to have it very much faster than that, where the dog is telling the handler the truth and taking them to the end because they've got the nose. I mean, that's why we hired them for the job, to find the bad guy, not me doing some guessing work at how their tail's moving or how hard they're pulling on the leash. It needs to be, do this because I say.
Yeah. So what does accountability look like?
So in the very beginning, I'm going to start with my e-collar, and I'm going to be layering extremely low level, meaning one or two on my collar, layering that low level taps with those light leash corrections. And I mean very light. Most of the time when the dog passes the turn, it's just their body weight hitting the end of the line, not slamming them. And I'm going to be offering multiple payments along the way. So their pace will be pretty slow after the first couple feet of the track because they realize their advantage is moving at that pace. They start figuring it out very quickly. But I don't speak. I'm not showing them anything. I'm simply having them paint a picture that later on, once we've done thousands of reps and we've layered e-collar in to where they really know what we're asking, and maybe we've gotten a little bit higher up into the 10 or 12 realm, then we start telling the dog, hey, there's true accountability here. You're going to find your advantage in the system is to take this 90 right where the 90 occurred, not 50 yards past it because the wind is up your butt. It's right on top of it. Because if you're in a very bad environment, maybe a trailer park where houses are on top of each other and a bad guy bangs a 90 in there with the wrong wind, that dog has to take that turn standing on it. Because there may be 10 or 12 people around them that may have warrants and drugs and guns on them, and a good dual dog may pick them out after losing the track for a second and say, hey, I'm going to go pick a fight with this guy, where we need them being dedicated to odor. And the only way to do that is to eventually show them an e-collar correction delivered at the right time and them understanding the task and them learn, okay, my advantage is just take this turn. And then I ultimately get paid along the way.
I don't mean to cut you off, but
no, you're good.
The correction or the e-collar stim is applied. The dog learn to turn that pressure off, or is this just kind of a little reminder of, hey?
So it depends. It depends if they are just passing a turn and I bump them and they immediately stop and come back to task, then it's just probably a one tap. If I'm right to the point where I'm adding distractions, you know, maybe we have kidnapped a cat and a chicken or two. We give them back. We don't keep them. We're going to turn them loose. But, that tends to be a lot of dogs' kryptonite. If they are just staring at that cat, maybe they're at the end of the 15-foot line. So that means they're about 15 foot from the footprints of the track. And I'm tap, 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 and they look back towards the track. I'm going to stop tapping there. Right. I don't think that they can pair that 15-foot distance to understand holding stem gets them all the way back. Right. So at that moment that I tap and they stay looking, I'll probably mark my verbal yes marker right there and direct reward on footprints. So now I've told them the distraction turns stem on, looking back in the direction of task away from the distraction, turns stem off, gets a marker, and then I reinforce my odor by paying right on footprints. So that brings the marker keys them to come back to me. Now I'm going to drop food right on footprints, and now we're back to track, and then they've forgotten about the distraction that we've implemented. Instead of traditional ways where we're just going to keep tapping, keep stemming, and hope that that 15-foot gap gets closed, where I don't think that in those beginning times of doing this, they're going to understand what we're asking.
Right. Right. So payment obviously is food. Mm-hmm. And yep. are they leaving the track to come back to you for payment?
So if the rule of thumb is if in the beginning we stay on the track, the handler stays on the footprints of odor. So whenever they're tracking and they offer something I like, I mark. And in the beginning for quite some time, it's going to be direct reward. So they're going to come to me, but I'm going to ignore them while I get food out of my food pouch. And then I'm going to lure them into a turn because most likely they're facing me. So I'm going to lure them into a turn where they're going away from me back on track. And I'm going to drop a handful right in footprints. Now they're having to really hunt for that kibble, deep nose into those footprints. But unlike traditional, like Schützen style, the food is in the footprints. That's where pace picks up. Because when there's something there for them to smell to cheat off of, they get good at picking up pace because they realize they just get faster and faster to get to the next spot where I don't want to have anything but target odor. No articles, no toys, no kibble, no nothing. I'm just marking and then I direct reward where I want it to be.
Okay. And then there's generally no issue of the dog reacquiring the track as nose is already in it.
No, exactly. And then as you advance, the ultimate goal is, honestly, there to be no payment. The payment is the dog doing the task, the dog coming out and getting over there to track. That is their payment and the ability to get them there and then want to work more and more and more because there's clarity of task. That's the payment. So through variable reward, we slowly get to that point because I was the handler that was told, take your toy with you, take food with you on live deployments, where I wanted to make a tougher, more hardened street dog that's not bullcrapping me for something that I have. I want the dog to do the task because I've taught him how to do it, and I need to rely that he's doing it because he understands it and he wants to, not working me for some payment that I may or may not give him. I think that in a court's eyes looks much better that, hey, we've trained the dog to a high level. He's not bullcrapping me like we see a lot of dogs do for a payment. They're too smart. They know the game. So we need to show them their advantage and their reward is doing what they love to do. When you take them out for a potty break, every one of them is just sucking the ground up. So why should we not believe that their payment in tracking is tracking? Their payment in detection is searching. That's what they love to do. We just mark what we desire and have that food reward. For me, I'm going to live on, dogs live on existential reward for as long as they can. I hate toys. If I've got a dog that's tracking like molasses, I may throw a toy in. But for the most part, a lot of guys get in fights, get bit, dogs overheat, all over a toy. So I want to stay on food for as long as I can.
Very good. So are you big on setting up rituals?
Let me tell you about our newest sponsor, Gold Coast Canine. Gold Coast 20-acre modern canine training facility is located in sunny Southern California and was established in 1991. Gold Coast owner Rodney Spicer was bitten by the Schützen bug in the mid-80s, and by the year 2000, He titled over 20 different dogs in a variety of working dog sports, from Schutzen to protection sports. This led him to eventually work with police dogs and began selling them to vendors. In the mid-90s, Gold Coast began selling dogs directly to police agencies. To date, Gold Coast supplies dogs to over 100 law enforcement agencies and provides training to 27 agencies for regularly scheduled maintenance training in both patrol and detection. Gold Coast has founded innovative canine courses such as canine stress inoculation, prior to deployments, and reality-based detection training. They've also introduced biometrics in the selection and evaluation period in order to increase the likelihood of success. Gold Coast developed a covert detection program for the largest technology company in the world. They also provide detection services to entertainment theme parks, hotels, and special events. When you think Gold Coast Canine, think reliable, experienced, and innovative. Check out goldcoastcanine.com for more information on your next single or dual-purpose canine. Also, check out their course schedule, merchandise, home protectors, and additional services. Follow Gold Coast Canine on all social media platforms. For a 10% discount on merchandise, use the GCK910 discount code.
Yes, mainly for starts. I want, you know, I've seen some traditional ways are like fake throwing the toy or big hand gestures with the command. You know, science has proven to us that tactile always overrides verbal. So you can speak a track or a dope command, but if you're doing a fake throw or making that big hand gesture when the dog is in a sit or a down and it's rocketing out of that behavior, it's not hearing a word you're saying. All you're doing is exploding their brain into them sometimes thinking you're tossing something. So now it's not truly about the task. It's hunting for whatever you've tossed. And now we've shot their motor into outer space and we've just cut our gas tank in half. So I want the dog to come up to the start of detection and tracking, only move on my word, whether it's dope, search, soup, track, doesn't matter. I want to make a hand presentation. If it's tracking, I want it to be on the ground and the dog in a down. If it's detection, dog in a sit, make my presentation to whatever is the first thing in the room or the car or the boat, backpack, whatever. And then when I see clarity from the dog peripherally and I see their target locked on my hand, their motor is not revving, they're not whining, they're closed mouth, and they're focused on me giving them that release, that's when I'll calmly give them that search or souk or whatever it is. And I want them to go right to where my hand is at, closed mouth, I'm going to step out of their way and get to work. But that start is so important, and we need to do it over and over and over to get that rep down. Along with, in the very early stages, especially for tracking, getting the dog to accept that scent article. Most dogs just fight their nose around it as you're presenting it, and handlers are trying to stick it on the dog's face. Dual dogs bite it to get it out of the way, and then the handler gets mad and just says, "Sook." And now the dog says, all I got to do is Stevie wander around it, and you'll leave me alone, and you'll let me go to work. So separately of tracking, I want the dog used to me being able to touch an object to their nose with their mouth closed, maybe all around their nose, and then we can get to work. So that just takes those consistent reps. You know, obviously, dual dogs, we don't always have, patrol dogs don't always have that scent article, very rarely. But when we do, they need to know how to accept it, not bite us over it, not bite it. And then that way we can get to task with clarity and not start out with a fight right off the bat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good. That was very specific. I was thinking we use there, I would call them maybe more preparatory ritual of giving the dog a break away from the track, coming back to the car, putting the vest on, all things that lead up to indicate to the dog, this is what we're getting ready to do.
Yeah. That's really cool. One of the biggest things for me is a walk command. So a right side, flat heel, essentially. That's where all of the dogs that I work with, that's where they go everywhere. The only time they hear or see, heeling is training, a school demo or something like that, and certification. So that way it stays very, very sharp. But that walk ultimately becomes a payment. So as the dog progresses, say they're doing detection or they're tracking and they mark an article, or they find odor, or they just clear a blank room and we've made it back to where our start's at, I'm going to say, yes, put the dog in a walk. The dog understands that behavior right after they potty in the start is what I put them in, and that takes them to start the task. Well, that behavior also, when I mark and they come back to me, it may take them to go run another car, go find another track, go run another, sniff another room. That behavior is a payment in and of itself, because we know dogs are gamblers and they're willing to gamble by getting into that behavior very fast and me bottling up that drive and kind of capping that energy so that I can get them refocused on another spot or just take them to the car. But they don't know and they don't care. They're gambling that they may get to go do something else. So consistently, it's going to be come out of the car, go break. I'm only going to give them probably 4 foot of lead standing at a tree where I know they're going to pee on it eventually. And as soon as they do, good job, walk. And now we go to task. But they're not allowed to drop their head at all. It is head up because the start and the end, in my opinion, is just human. The dogs don't understand where the start is. They don't understand where the end is. So in my opinion, if we just let them be at the end of a 6 foot line on our way to track and their head is down and they're actually tracking because they understand that start drill, now there's a high probability that we're jumping from odor to odor to odor as they're going along. So then we wonder why is he jumping from target odor into picking up this cross track where we allowed it in the beginning? We allowed it as we go to and from our track. So what is allowed will continue, where I want to have head up to the start. At the end of the track, I mark pay. I tell the dog all done. And then I tell it walk head up all the way to the car because we can inadvertently allow them to be switching odor when we don't want to. We don't think about it, but it's what they're doing. They don't know the end and the beginning, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Very good. You've given, I know you've given me a lot of things to think about. And I know you've given a lot of our listeners plenty to think about. I know that's been kind of the theme every time we've spoken. To me, I feel like I want to know more and more. I would say that my tracking is not been something that I've been super, super passionate about. You know, I think about when I first got into this, it was the bite work that enthralled me. Mm-hmm. And then I had several moments where I realized that, oh, there's a whole lot more to this than just biting people.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, there is.
So I've learned a good bit about detection, I feel like, over the last few years, where I really upped my game. Mm-hmm. And I feel like tracking is where I really need to up my game right now. I feel good about the bite work and obedience. Yep. And there's always new things to learn. I'm always hopeful that somebody will find something new under the sun. But there's plenty to learn.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's what I tell handlers at the end of a 3 or 4 or 5 day seminar, man, we're just scratching the surface. I try to give us, I'm all, you know, you teach classes as well. And something I struggle with is it information overload or do I leave there feeling like I didn't give them enough? Like, did I not give them as much as I could in that short amount of time? And you talk to some handlers, you know, debriefing after, and they say, man, I feel like it was just overwhelming. And then you get some that are like, oh, I just want more. So I think either way, you just try to, at least for me, I try to give as much as I can and try to make it as clear as I can so that I know when I leave them that they've got a really good direction, a really good heading, and they've got some tools in the toolbox to start implementing. And then when they need something, I give them my number. I may not be good about getting back right away just because I've got a lot going on. But right before we got on, a handler texted me that I just talked to a few days ago. And I said, hey, whenever I wrap up with this, I'll give you a call and we'll get some clarity to it. Because there's always going to be those questions. But I think as trainers, we have to make ourselves available to those guys, because I was one of those handlers just stuck in a hole and not really knowing where to go. So I feel like it's something that I have to do with any time I interact with those guys that are like, hey, I want to learn more. I need help. Make myself available for it as much as I can, because I know how it feels not to feel like you're not doing everything you can and kind of failing your dog at some time. So. Mm-hmm.
I think that it's easy. The things that you are describing to me, this is where I'm almost a little perplexed, because I think a lot of what you do is probably vastly different than what they've experienced.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You should see faces. I just worked with a very large state agency. Boy, it was like I kicked them in the nads that, mm-hmm. with the PowerPoint right. side of it. And mm-hmm. because, it, you know, like they said, we've just been doing this same way for so long, and we're getting bit, and we're eventually getting dogs that aren't engaging, and because we're fighting them. And I'm like, man, we just, yes, there are those dogs that sometimes we have to have a conversation with, but in my opinion, we should be able to get them to do high-level work and never have to touch them, never have to put our hands on them. And you know, I tell the guys, this is not going to look like what you think tracking is the first day or two. But in my opinion, one, if we're not doing it to a high level and we're seeking help, then the definition of insanity is continuing mm-hmm. doing the same thing, looking for a different result. But two, why lay and fumble through a 500-yard track when we can't track efficiently for 5 feet? Right. So it's going to look weird in the beginning because we have to be able to crawl before we can run. So let's get clarity of task. Let's get the dog started on a contract where we say, hey, it's got to be A, B, and C first. Then we can start progressing from there. But when they see it, like when we start progressing them, it's difficult. That the guy, after the second day, the guys are like, we would 100% of our dogs can't do these tracks in these environments. For sure, guaranteed, they cannot do this. And after that second day, they were like, holy crap, our dogs are actually doing this. This is crazy. So yeah. it can be done. We just have to know that we're not the smarter ones in the equation between the dog and the handler, that they are capable of much higher level work. We just have to learn how to communicate it and then hold them to it.
Right. Very good. Now, do you find that there are some dogs that just generally pick up on this process quicker than others?
Besides police dogs, Gold Coast Canine sells canine home protectors. Gold Coast Canine trains and develops top-tier home protection dogs that leverage their specialized security and protection training to keep their home and family safe. Each home protection dog is hand-selected and goes through a rigorous screening process prior to training to determine their natural physical and mental aptitudes. This in-depth evaluation ensures they have the ideal temperament and work ethic to create the perfect family companion and home protector. The canine home protectors are thoroughly trained in obedience, agility, barking on command, searching a residence for intruders, and searching, monitoring outdoor perimeters. The canine home protectors are sociable and vigilant. Their concierge service offers regularly scheduled maintenance training, annual refresher, home visits, veterinary care, and board and train while out of town. Gold Coast Canine Home Protector is also well socialized with other dogs, humans, and animals of other species to ensure they are extremely well balanced. You can think of the Gold Coast Canine Home Protectors as family companions with added abilities. Check out goldcoastcanine.com for a full list of training offerings. Also, follow Gold Coast Canine on all social media platforms. Remember to use the GCK910 discount code for 10% off Gold Coast Canine merchandise.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, absolutely. And then most of the time it's, you know, when we're working with pointy eared, most of the time it's the shepherds, you know, especially a lot of times where I teach, I'm working with dogs that already are tracking and already have some mm-hmm. street bites. And in my seminars, I always work the dogs. I'm the one working the line for the first about 3 days. So I do get tagged quite a bit, but it's just getting through it because there's so much value in footsteps in the second that the dog needs to take a step forward. There's so much value in little taps of pressure from the leash right in that moment, and then a marker to follow and a payment to follow to say, hey, not this, but it's that. So to get that progression in these seminars, that's what it's got to be. And that's kind of what set me as well on this path is I remember we were doing a Canines United in Camp Blanding, and there was probably 115 teams at this seminar. And Jay Nix, he was breaking everybody up saying, hey, you're going to go here for this station, here for this station. For tracking, you're going to stay right here. And everybody broke up, and there was still 50 teams standing in front of me. And I was like, holy crap, how in the world am I going to do this? Well, after two or three days of dogs who aren't on a marker, are not on existential reward, they only know toys, have multiple street bites because they're in Florida, and they Florida tends to bite a lot of people. How am I going to get them to put their nose in a food bowl with a nail and a washer driven through the center of it and get the behavior I'm wanting? And then the handler to be able to go back after this seminar and actually be able to reproduce it himself. It did not go well. So I had to go back to my drawing board and say, like, if I'm going to be called for seminars like this, I've got to do better. I've got to step my game up. And that's kind of the path it's set on. And man, it has really made a system that within 3 to 5 day seminar, 100% of the dogs are doing drastically better than they were.
That's great. Very good. Well, we definitely want to have you out here. I think our teams would definitely benefit from it. I know that I would benefit from it.
And it's the same. It's, in my opinion, tracking is detection. Detection is tracking. It's nose work. It's the same rules. It's work efficiently. Don't burn your gas tank and don't pass odor. I've seen dogs do that a lot. They narrow down source and then they're gone to searching. They leave a section of wall and they spin around behind you and you got to swap hands and represent. I don't like any of that. I want the dogs, if they get to the end of a search area that I want them searching, they need to turn back into the wall and search back down it the same as what they did going down, not wait. Because every bit of movement from the dog that is not what I want is a waste of energy. It's causing them to end the search or the track quicker than what I want them to. So I need them to learn their advantage is to harness their energy, work efficiently, not kill themselves, and be honest, be truthful with me. So that in detection, that being truthful looks like, you know, a 15 room search with distractors out everywhere with no target odors out. I tell handlers all the time, I don't mean this arrogantly. I mean it as a real truth. It does not impress me for the dog to walk into a 7-room search with 5 odors out. Finding the odor, finding the track, that's easy. That is super, super easy for the most part. The hard part is going into a 10-room search and there not being anything but distractors out. And the handler, after that first blank, second blank, they start to feel that warm rush over them, like, oh man, I'm missing it. Then the third blank and fourth blank, now they're presenting things over and over and over where they're seeing maybe a behavior change. And then they ultimately talk the dog into alerting, where we need the dog to never be able to be talked into alerting. If it's detection, it's odor is the only thing that pays them, just keep searching. And I remember my first call to sniff a car and I ran it and the dog didn't alert. And I was like, holy crap, he didn't alert. That's not what's supposed to happen. He's supposed to find odor. And I had to tell the deputy that called me there, hey, I didn't get anything. It's clear. And I remember right then thinking, I don't want to feel like that anymore. I want to feel confident in my dog. I want to be able to turn around and say, hey, there's nothing here. And by getting all your odors down, distractions, proofers, very early on, and then getting the dog to be able to run a lot of blanks is the goal. Right. And the same thing for tracking. Run, hunt for a track for 5 acres, and then you find the track. That's real world stuff, and that's what we got to be working towards.
Very good. Very good. You know, it has occurred to me that, and we've had this conversation at training, where I've encouraged guys to go out and try to initiate a track with their dog where they know there's not one there.
100%. My favorite scenario is pull a car into an open field where I know that no human being has been. Right. Pull another car right up to it, crawl out through a window, roll the windows up, AC is off, and drive out of there. And then I tell the guys, hey, you've got an abandoned stolen vehicle. See if you can get a direction of travel. And I want them to just cut a box around that car with the dog's nose. And the goal is to turn right around after cutting that box and say, there's nothing leaving here. There's no track. So that's what we should have is right. the dog to be honest with us and say, hey, there's nothing here. That's the most difficult part. It's more about where it's not than about where it is.
Yeah. That's good stuff. Cause I had a handler just a couple weeks ago that had a successful track with a find. And then he also had one that was very similar to what you just described. Mm-hmm. It was a situation where there was a care worker who has had a disabled child or teenager with them. And the supervisor had been suspecting that she'd been stopping by her house and going inside and leaving this child unattended. Well, that's exactly mm-hmm. what had happened. So the caretaker goes to her home. She goes in the house. The supervisor comes by and sees the child unattended and takes the child, but doesn't tell the care worker. So now they think that this child is missing. Handler gets there and he's trying to initiate a track and he's trying and trying and trying, and supervision is, you know, on the phone with him about what's going on. And he says, I'm not picking up anything. And then the supervisor shows up and it all comes to light. So
finding a track is easy. It's the dog saying there's nothing here. I had a call. It was a call out day shift, shooting, double homicide. The only thing that the responding zone unit got from one of the people right before they passed was he went out the front door. That's all the victim said. Well, it was like a 5-acre piece of property out in the middle of nowhere with a bunch of barns and sheds. I had to cap this 5-acre property line to look for a track leaving there. And about the time I was just getting to the end of it, my dog hammers a track. And then you see footprints running through the woods once we got on the track. But if all your tracks start right on odor, right on odor, right on odor, you're never going to be able to hunt for a direction of travel or just see if there's a track there. So you really have to make sure that early on you're not starting dead on odor every time. I want to cut the dog in at a 90 right. degrees every single time.
Very good. Well, that makes me feel good about some of the stuff that we do.
For sure. Absolutely.
We do those things.
Yep.
Certainly do. All right. Very good. I think we've given our listeners a tremendous amount to think about and good information. Mike, tell us or tell everyone how they can reach you.
If it's seminar related, it's much better to contact my wife because she'll be able to handle everything. So her email is Suzy@MLK9.com. And then some guys think I'm nuts for giving out my cell phone, but man, I want to be able to help out as much as I can. So if they have a question about any of this, it's better to just shoot me a text. It's 239-243-1459. And then we have our social media pages, which if it's not Ridgeside pet related, I really don't do a lot, but MLK9 or Mike Lilly K9, you can find me on anything there. So I'm really bad about putting working dog stuff out on there. And really because there's so many difference of opinions, you post a video and everybody's got something to say about it. And I could care less about all that crap. So,
Right. Well, very good. I appreciate you taking your time this evening and
no, thanks for having me.
We will be in touch for sure.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Sounds good.
Thanks so much, you guys, for following along, supporting us, and listening to these wonderful conversations that Howard and I are just blessed to have each and every day. We'd like to thank and support all of our first responders, police, fire, EMS, and our military for once again holding the line, keeping us safe. Stay safe, brothers and sisters. We love you. God bless, and God bless America.